Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today we will be interviewing Professor Macer, the John P. Wilson Professor of Law, Director of the Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz Program in Behavioral Law, Finance, and Economics. You've received a bachelor's in political science and a bachelor's in physics at Stanford University and a JD from Harvard Law School. After graduating from law school, you clerked for Chief Justice Marilyn Hall Patel of the United States District Court for the Northern District of California and Judge Richard Posner of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. You joined the law school faculty in 2007, serving as the deputy dean from 2012 to 2014, and was named the John P. Wilson Professor of Law in 2014. You've won the Graduating Students Award for Teaching Excellence in many years, and you've authored the book that we're going to be discussing today called Happiness and the Law by the University of Chicago Press in 2015. And your research and teaching interests include patent law, administrative law, behavioral law, and economics and criminal law. My name is Kenan, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. So to start off with, could you start off with your time as starting from undergrad all the way to where you are now? But I do have to say, as a Cal Bear, I do have to look down on Stanford.
Totally understood. I wouldn't have it any other way. And thank you very much for having me on your podcast. Right. So I've always had these sort of dual interests, an interest in science and an interest in sort of political science and law. And so those were the two degrees I did as an undergrad. And then I spent a year after college working on Capitol Hill. I worked for Zoe Lofgren, who's a member of Congress representing San Jose, and she sits on the Science Committee. And I was her Science Committee advisor for a year. So again, it gave me a chance to kind of marry my two interests in law and in science. And then after that, I went to law school at Harvard, as you said. And I clerked for 2 years for two very different judges, and learned an enormous amount from both of them. And then I came to the University of Chicago after that, first as a Bigelow Fellow, and then as a tenure track faculty member, and I haven't left since.
So the next thing that we're going to be discussing is your work in happiness and the law. At first glance, I'm curious to hear initially, what is, how do you connect happiness and the law together?
Right. So let me tell you what this book is not about. It's not about how to live a happy life. It's not about how to be happy in the legal profession. There are a lot of people who write sort of self-help books about those sorts of things, which might be valuable, but that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a new psychology of happiness, sometimes called hedonic psychology, or alternatively, subjective well-being. We use happiness and subjective well-being interchangeably. They mean basically the same thing. And it's basically trying to understand how well someone's life is going in terms of their mental states. So, what makes for a good life in this picture is being happy, having positive thoughts, being excited to live each day and not feeling morose or depressed or upset or anxious or unhappy in some fashion. So there's a big psychological literature built up around hedonics, happiness, led by Daniel Kahneman, who is a Nobel laureate in economics and did a lot of the pioneering work in this regard. And our project, what our book is about, is understanding the ramifications that this big literature on hedonic psychology has for law. And what we're trying to establish in the book is that the what we've learned about what makes people happy and sort of how they think about their own lives should influence the way we think about law in a number of pretty substantial ways. And so that's really what the book is focusing on, how we could think differently about our laws, both our civil laws and our criminal laws and even our regulatory laws, in light of this literature on hedonic psychology.
That sounds like a very interesting topic to use hedonic psychology in the law. And I'm curious to hear how exactly does the law do that? How would a law even ensure someone's happiness?
Right. So let's take criminal law as an example. That's a topic we've written quite a lot about, and it comprises a big chunk of the book. So imagine two people who commit two different crimes and are sentenced to two different terms in prison. Let's suppose one person commits a less serious crime and is sentenced to 5 years in prison, and another person commits a more serious crime and is sentenced to 10 years in prison. I think if you asked a person on the street, how much more severe is the 10 years in prison punishment than the 5 years? They would say it's twice as severe. It's twice as many years in prison. It's twice as severe a punishment. And I think that that is sort of the approach that law has taken, essentially since the very beginning. That's how judges think about this. That's how legislatures think about this. That's how juries think about this. But if you really dive into the hedonic psychology literature on what it means to be in prison and the effects that prison has on your life, what you come to understand is that 5 years is not half as long as 10 years. It's not half as much punishment. And that's true for a couple of reasons. Reason number one is that people tend to adapt to prison. People adapt to all kinds of different life circumstances. I mean, think about something really great that's happened to you or something really terrible that's happened to you. It probably had a big impact on your life at the very beginning. And then that impact faded a little bit as you sort of forgot about it or stopped thinking about it. Prison is the same way. The first 6 months in prison are much worse. But after that, people start to adapt to prison somewhat, and prison becomes, while still awful in many ways, not quite as awful. And so that means that after those first 6 months, all the sort of those out years, the rest of that time, it's more similar than you might imagine. And the second and much more important factor is that even after someone is released from prison, the consequences of having been in prison do not end. So when people are released from prison, they are typically in bad physical health. Prison is a place where people contract a lot of diseases that linger and cause a great sort of long-term diminution of their happiness. It's hard to form relationships after one has left prison, and often the relationships that you had before prison are broken up by having been in prison. It's very hard for people to get jobs, as we know. It's very hard to sort of re-enter society and find gainful employment, especially at the level you're at before, after you leave prison. So what that means is that the person who serves the shorter term of 5 years, and 5 years is really a pretty long prison term generally, the person who serves even that shorter term, the years after they're released from prison are going to be very difficult years for them hedonically. It's going to really diminish their well-being. And that's going to continue outwards for essentially the entirety of their lives. It never becomes easy for someone who's been convicted to find a job. It never becomes easy for them to build the kinds of relationships they had before they were incarcerated. And so what that means is that that person who was in prison for 5 years, they continue to suffer quite a lot even after they're released. So too for the person who's been in prison for 10 years, but those extra 5 years of punishment, those extra 5 years of being in prison, they don't make as much of a difference as you might imagine. So what our research shows is that 5 years in prison is not half as bad as 10 years in prison. They're really quite close together. 10 years in prison is only maybe a little bit worse than 5 years in prison. And in fact, all of these punishments are much, much worse than probably anyone understood, because the consequences of prison go on for someone's life. You continue to punish someone for their entire life because of these sort of collateral effects of having been incarcerated. So what this means is we have a criminal justice system that's built around the idea that 10 years in prison is twice as much punishment than 5 years. But from a hedonic perspective, it's not twice as much. It's maybe a little bit more than 5 years. So we're punishing people for different crimes with relatively similar sentences. And we're punishing everyone far, far too much, much, much more than the system seems to intend because of all of these long-term consequences for having been in prison. So from a sort of naive, you know, count the years type of way, 10 years in prison is twice as much as 5 years, and we can calibrate punishment that way. From a hedonic perspective, it doesn't look like that at all. And this gives rise to a series of potential reforms that we could think about to try to end these practices. First of all, prison terms should probably be much, much shorter. And secondly, there should probably be a much greater investment in efforts to reintegrate people into society after they leave prison, make it easier for them to find jobs, make it easier for them to build relationships and establish social ties again. And that's a way to stop this sort of effective practice of continuing to punish people for the entirety of their lives. And so those are a specific set of important potential legal reforms and a way to understand the criminal justice system that you get out of looking at things through a hedonic lens that you wouldn't otherwise understand.
Well, first of all, thank you, Professor, for telling our audience and myself about your research from a hedonic perspective. I do want to add a perspective in that my grandfather was also a prisoner of war. He was a captain of the South Vietnam Army, and he was jailed by the communists for over 10 years. And he actually lives with me. He's right next door, and I talk to him a lot about his time in prison, at those communist camps. And he suffered a lot within those 10 years. And I would say that from his perspective, if he got out in 5 years, it would have been much, much exponentially better to get back with his family, which includes my grandma, my father, and my mother, if he served only 5 years. But because he served a decade, there was so much suffering in my entire Vietnamese American family, my Vietnamese family, in which my grandma had to visit him in prison so many times, and he was just in there, and they had to fend for themselves. And in my view, I think that 10 years is way worse than 5 years. And I think that numeric amount might not be as correct from a hedonic perspective. And from a criminal justice standpoint, in terms of reforms, I mean, my grandfather and his family got to go to America because of a public policy proposal, and they came to America and reintegrated very quickly, became very staunch conservatives and Republicans, and my grandfather started an education sort of tutoring company. He became an educator and a principal of a place, and he did that through entrepreneurship rather than a job system. So I mean, to your point about reforming the criminal justice system, I think in my view, I think it should be more towards helping folks start small businesses, start entrepreneurship, and also have the prison system account for prisoners of war. I mean, those are just my unconnected thoughts. So I mean, what do you think of that, and how would you respond to my thoughts?
Well, thank you. I mean, I appreciate you sharing your perspective, and it's a very powerful story about your family. I guess what I would say is that our research is about prison in the United States. It's about state and federal prisons in the United States and the population of people incarcerated in state and federal prisons. And all of the hedonic research that we look at is based on those populations of people. And so the experience of someone who's imprisoned overseas for political reasons and then comes to the United States, I'm not surprised to hear that it was very different. And of course, you know, the policy recommendations that we have are recommendations about the current system of incarceration in the United States. They wouldn't necessarily extend to the type of situation that your family was in.
I mean, it might be relevant because when my grandpa came to America, he had entrepreneurship and small business opportunities. Why not do the same in that sort of program for let's say the folks out in South Chicago? We provide them with the abilities to start their own businesses, the ability to start their own companies, and have them be independent, self-sufficient, and pull themselves up by the bootstraps, similar to how my grandfather did it.
Sure. I mean, I don't think there's any reason not to. You know, when I say that the important thing is to provide resources for people to reintegrate themselves, I mean that in terms of whether they're getting a job at a business run by somebody else or starting their own business, it's hard to get yourself off the ground in that enterprise when you've come out of an American prison, in great part because of the stigma that attaches to having been in prison. That's probably a very different situation than your grandfather found himself in. So certainly, you know, programs that helped people become entrepreneurs and trained them to open their own businesses would be very valuable as well. Now, of course, training is not enough. People need resources. They need loans, et cetera. But any of those sorts of resources that can be provided, I think, will probably pay very significant dividends for the reasons that we've described in our book.
I mean, one promising solution is I talked to Professor Sachs of U Chicago Booth, and he talked about the Polsky exchange program and the Polsky entrepreneurship program, in which the program's mission is to help underrepresented minorities and folks out in South Chicago with entrepreneurship and innovation. I in my view, I think there should be more investment towards entrepreneurship and small businesses as opposed to straight up government programs. I mean, what's your response to that? I'm curious to hear.
I'm not sure I know what the difference is exactly here. I mean, I think either way, what we're talking about is an investment in people who need resources invested in them to help them either create businesses or get jobs. That's probably going to have to be a government program. Now, some of it might be funded privately through a charity or something, but it will probably be a government program of some sort, regardless. At least that's certainly what we're suggesting, is that the same government that incarcerates people should invest money in preparing them for life after incarceration. So whether that government program takes the form of training someone to hold a job in a business run by somebody else or training them to open their own business, both of those seem extremely valuable to me. Either way, we think that it makes sense for the government to invest resources in training people to have those opportunities after they've been incarcerated.
I suspect that the government might not be the most efficient form of way to train folks in the workforce. Like take me, for example, going to a school like University of California, Berkeley. There are a lot of things that go through a lot of bureaucracy and are slower to handle than as opposed to the flower shop that my parents started in their garage. You know, if there's an idea, my parents start a flower shop and they sell flowers out in North San Jose. And they serve the South Bay Area community. I advise them on sales, on marketing, and all that stuff. And I helped them start their business in April when they lost their jobs. And they've been able to really have new ideas be expanded really quickly and make a ton of money on their own and be independent and are happier because of it, as opposed to when they were working in a giant factory as blue collar workers or as potential as government employees. And in my view, I think putting money into folks' independence and giving them the independence to start their own companies, businesses, entrepreneurships are is much better than the government, which, you know, I'm still waiting for some emails from some of the librarians and chancellors from my school because I'm waiting on them. Whereas when I was talking to my friends at Stanford, you know, they get a ton of attention. They get things done really quickly. And for some reason, my parents' business does the same way. So, I'm in the camp of privatization and as opposed to government intervention. How would you respond to that, professor?
Well, first of all, I did not think that the direction this conversation was going to go was you running down Berkeley and promoting the virtues of Stanford. So I guess I'm grateful for that. But I would say, look, I think that there are some things that the private sector is good at doing. There are some things that the government is good at doing. The prison population in the United States now is roughly 2 million people. And so it's going to take a lot of private sector investment to provide the resources for all of those people. I think that there are perfectly reasonable arguments about exactly how we might want to structure programs for people coming out of prison. That's not really what our book is about. That's not really what our research is about. So, you know, we can differ about the values or virtues of the private sector versus the public sector in this regard. But that's sort of not the point at some level. The point, as far as we're concerned, is that when people come out of prison, they need investment in order to help them reintegrate into society, and someone needs to be making that investment. It's not occurring currently.
Well, in that case, let's delve right back into your book, professor, and in your book you talk about certain moral norms, adaptive preferences, hedonic psychology within the law. Could you discuss their theoretical framework to our audience and tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll say that these are not just theoretical ideas. These are pretty well established empirically. So, I mean, there are a lot of different psychological tendencies that people have that have now been pretty well established by the behavioral psychologists who work in this area. One of them is adaptation, which I described earlier, the tendency for any sort of substantial change in life to fade in importance over time as we get used to it. And that's a very sort of powerful kind of human protective ability in some sense. Like we want to be able to get used to our surroundings and not be thrown off path too much if something bad happens to us. And so the ability to adapt is a very powerful and useful human trait. Another one is what's called affective forecasting errors. And that's just a fancy way of saying that people are bad at predicting how they're going to feel about certain things in the future. So, you know, a lot of times we make decisions on the basis of trying to guess at whether those decisions will make us happy or make us unhappy. Those decisions might be anything from where do we want to go to college or graduate school to do we want to move out of the city and into the suburbs in order to have a bigger house, but also a longer commute to work if people still commute to work. And those are the sorts of decisions we make. Well, we try to guess, we try to forecast how we're going to feel, what our affect will be going forward. And what we've learned is that people tend to be quite bad at that, actually. They guess wrongly a lot of times about what will really matter to them. They guess incorrectly about what will make them more or less happy. And they often overestimate how important certain things to them will be, like having a bigger house, and underestimate how important other sorts of things will be. So what this means is that we can't always rely on the decisions that people make as the best possible guide to what will actually be good for them. People make those decisions not necessarily knowing what they want, and then what it turns out that they feel about it afterwards sometimes deviates from what they expected.
And what do you propose will guide people in their right decisions then?
Well, again, you know, our book is not really about trying to get people to make better decisions or lead better lives. That's the work of other people. What we think the upshot of this is that when we're trying to gauge whether something is good for people, we ought to think about after the fact, after it happens to them, how do they feel about it, rather than before the fact, do they want it or not? So economists base a lot of their decision-making on before-the-fact estimations by people about whether they want something or not. They try to observe, did the person want to buy that good? How much were they willing to spend on it? How much were they willing to spend on a safety feature on their car? How much do they value their own safety, et cetera? And they use those sorts of decisions that people make before the fact as evidence of how much people value things. And what we're trying to say is when people make decisions before the fact like that, they are often guessing about how that decision will impact them. And after the fact, how they feel about it might be very different. So instead of looking at what people do before the fact, let's look at how they feel about things, how those things actually impact their lives after the fact, and use that as our guide to what's actually good for those people. And this becomes very relevant when the government is regulating the environment, let's say. So that's one of the examples we talk about at length in our book. If the government is trying to decide, you know, to whether or not to impose a particular regulation, maybe that regulation costs a certain amount of money, but it will also save some number of lives. The government will typically look at people's spending decisions before the fact in order to gauge whether people would want to make this trade-off or not. And then after the fact, the people might actually feel very differently about it. So what we suggest in our book is that rather than using these typical economic methodologies of looking at people's spending decisions before the fact to gauge whether people want to engage in some trade-off, we should look at how that trade-off actually affects their well-being after the fact. And the government should use that as its guide to determining whether a particular regulation is a good idea and will help people or a bad idea that won't help them.
Would it make sense for the government to impose ideas on individual decisions? Because, for example, I'm a project coordinator for my parents' flower shop, and my role is to negotiate with local businesses, churches, consumers, and we create and negotiate prices, and through the various use of these negotiations, prices ultimately change. So let's say there was a poor individual who couldn't afford flowers for their funeral. We could lower the price for them. Or if there was someone who wanted a premium on their flowers, let's say they had a wedding coming up and they want to give their wife, you know, a really amazing flower bouquet, and so we'll give them a premium product. And so for us, when we're running this flower shop, we make prices based on consumer needs and based on that. And what if the government walks into us and tells us, hey, we have to make all our flowers for, I don't know, $50. That's gonna ruin our business. That's gonna run my parents out of business, and that's gonna disrupt the whole system. How would you respond to that?
Right. That's not the kind of thing we're talking about at all. So what we're talking about is, like, take a typical case of environmental regulation. Suppose you have a coal burning power plant that's emitting mercury into the air, and that mercury eventually settles into the water systems and gets into fish. And then when it gets into human beings, it causes cancer and kills people. So that factory is imposing harm on all the people around it by giving them cancer and causing them to die earlier than they would die otherwise. And so what do you do in that situation? Well, the people can't very well bargain with the factory and kind of work out some deal where the factory stops emitting mercury. First of all, the factory is not going to want to do that. Secondly, it's pretty hard for some factory to, you know, power plant to bargain with some very dispersed group of people. So the way that we handle problems like that, environmental problems like that in the United States, is that we have the federal government through the Environmental Protection Agency regulate the emissions of these toxic pollutants by the factory or the power plant. And so the EPA will set a limit on how much mercury that power plant is permitted to emit, or how many such power plants are permitted to operate in a particular area. And when it sets that limit, it's not just sort of making up numbers or ideas out of thin air. It's trying to kind of pick the limit that the factory owner and the people around it would actually bargain to, what the people, what the citizens actually would want if they were the ones making the decision. And so to do that, you, as I said, usually it looks at their sort of before the fact purchasing decisions. And we're talking about the government using kind of after the fact indicators of how much people's lives are affected instead. But this is a place where, you know, when it's your parents' flower shop, you can work these things out on a one-to-one basis. There is no need for government intervention, and indeed, there is no government intervention. But when it comes to large-scale environmental problems like this, there is no substitute for the government being involved to curb the harm that private enterprises are imposing on the people around them.
And let's talk about the EPA. And there has been criticism about the EPA and how you mentioned selecting numbers out of thin air. There have been criticism that they select data out of thin air to evaluate chemical risk. According to Bloomberg Law, the EPA has been criticized for how it selects data to evaluate chemical risk. So just like small businesses might be able to select certain numbers, the EPA and government institutions could do the same. And how would you respond to that? How would we ensure that a government institution like the EPA doesn't take advantage of regular individuals and small businesses?
I mean, first of all, the EPA is not selecting numbers out of thin air. Those criticisms, if that's in fact how they're being phrased, they're just false. The EPA makes mistakes. Sometimes agencies get things wrong. They are staffed by human beings who are fallible, and human beings make mistakes. And so any agency can get things wrong. And I'm sure that the EPA gets things wrong sometimes. But when the EPA gets things wrong, its regulations can be challenged in court. There can be an adjudication in front of a judge. Or for that matter, if you don't like what the EPA is doing, you can vote the president out of office who's in charge of the EPA. These agencies are accountable to the people through the democratic process via their votes for president. So agencies are certainly not perfect, but there are mechanisms for making sure that they do a reasonable job and holding them accountable. There are lots of other mechanisms which I haven't described here. But more to the point, like, what is the alternative exactly? Is the alternative to just let everyone spew as much pollution as they would like? That seems preposterous and like an obviously bad idea. So, you know, the day that someone comes up with a better idea than sort of having a government agency try to regulate what private parties are doing, I think that will be an interesting idea to describe and to discuss. But in the United States, what we're doing with using the government to try to curb the harms that certain businesses or individuals can impose on others, it seems like the only feasible approach.
There might be another approach, like under the Reagan administration, in which there were bills for conservation.
I'm not even sure what that means exactly in this context. I mean, conservation is just the government. I assume what you mean is the government coming in and telling some business that it can't do something or that it can't build on some type of land. But I don't exactly know what you have in mind, particularly, or how that would solve the problem that we're discussing.
I mean, for example, President Reagan signed into law 38 bills that added more than 10.6 million acres of forests, mountains, deserts, and wetlands to the National Wilderness Preservation System. And I suspect that may curb pollution, because we're also giving lands and areas in which there are places where you can breathe better, places like me, myself, who I I used to use an inhaler, and I would go out to those forests, and they would be places where I could really breathe well and feel free. So that could be another potential solution.
Right. I mean, that's those things are great. Those measures are terrific. They are not a solution to this type of problem. I mean, those measures by themselves wouldn't stop a power plant located just outside of Oakland, California, from emitting all sorts of toxic pollutants that affected all the people who live in Oakland, California. Setting aside land like that makes it less polluted, but it also is land that people are not living on. So these things are nice complements to one another, but they're not substitutes for one another. You can't solve the problem of industrial pollution just by having some land set aside that's conserved. In addition to which, air floats around and water, trickles from stream to stream. And so even those conserved areas could be heavily polluted if you did not regulate the polluting activities of the power plants and the factories outside of those areas of conservation.
I want to zoom back into your book and talk about the law and economics aspect.
Sure.
Could you talk through some of the common questions about the objections to the use of happiness research in law and economics?
Well, I think that the primary objection is that it relies on asking people how they're feeling at any given moment. Economists really like to rely on actual decisions that people make with actual monetary stakes on the table. So they really like to look at, what did this person actually buy? What does that tell us about their views about their own life or their safety? And they really don't want to look at what did this person say about how much they value this or that quantity. In theory, like maybe someday there will be a little devices that we can insert into people that will tell us how happy they are. But until that day comes, we just have to ask people how happy they are, ask people how well their lives are going, and then we have to rely on the answers that they're giving. And that makes economists nervous whenever you're asking people a question and then relying on the answer. And I think that that concern is a very legitimate one. But we offer sort of two responses to that concern. Number one is that we know that people are making systematic errors when they make before the fact decisions about what to buy or how much to spend on something. And so, relying on that, while it is concrete, we know it's going to be infected by errors and sort of effective forecasting mistakes and the like. So asking people after the fact has virtues in that we don't think it's going to be necessarily error-ridden in that same regard. And the second thing is that there are a lot of questions we might ask people where they'd have an incentive to tell us something other than the truth. So if we asked people, how much do you value clean air? Or how much do you value, automobile safety on the highway? They might give us an abnormally high or abnormally low number for political reasons, or to sort of signal what their values are or their ideology, or because they want to particularly make some kind of policy change happen. But for hedonic psychology to do its work and for our sort of approach to law to function properly, we don't have to ask them questions like that. We just have to ask them, how happy are you right now? And people don't necessarily have nearly as much of an incentive to prevaricate about how happy they are at a given moment as they do about other things when they're being asked specifically about questions that might influence policy. So we think that we're going to get much more reliable answers to the questions that we would need to ask to make this version of law work than we would if we were giving them other sorts of questions. So the concern that economists raise is fair, but we think it's overblown in this circumstance, and the advantages that this approach has over standard economic methodologies are still pretty large.
Great, and that's all I wanted to talk about on your book, which is on happiness and the law. And it's going to be available on Amazon, and where else would it be available, Professor Maser, that our audience
It's
can get the
published
book?
by the University of Chicago Press, so you can get it from the University of Chicago Press website or your local academic bookstore. But
Watching the hour, and I want to thank you for coming on to the podcast. And is there anything else, Professor Maser, that you want to address to our audience in terms of either your book or any publications you might have coming up? To because I think our audience and myself would love to continue to read your work.
Nothing else. I just wanted to thank you again for having me on, and thank you for a very stimulating conversation.
Well, awesome. Well, that's all the time we have now. And I just want to thank every single person listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. And next time we'll have even more great professors like Professor Maser speaking on more topics on public policy, entrepreneurship, and even more. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all of your friends to do that as well. And also check out Professor Maser's book, Happiness and the Law, and also a lot of his publications as well. Thank you so much.